totally normal to not be what you think is normal. You don't have to go once a day. You don't have to go once in the morning to be normal. Normal just has to be two things in my books. One of those things is it should be comfortable for you. You shouldn't strain. It should be effortless. That's one criteria. And then two, it should occur at socially appropriate times. I actually think this is the secret of highly successful people. I'm not kidding you. Everyone's like, oh, highly successful people, they make their bed every day. No, I think they budget time to poop every day. But they're just, that's not the one that makes it to Forbes magazine. But I think that's the secret.
Welcome to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast, where we meet the world's top experts to explore the secrets of health, mindset, longevity, and so much more. Are you ready to take charge of your existence and biohack your life? This show is for you. Please keep in mind, we're not dispensing medical advice and are not responsible for any outcomes you may experience from implementing the tactics lying herein. So friends, are you ready to join me? Let's do this. Welcome back to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Oh my goodness, friends, you're in for such a treat today with Dr. Trisha Pasricha. As you guys know, I love talking about bowel movements, including how to troubleshoot them and how to optimize them. And today's episode just might blow your mind. I cannot recommend her book, You've Been Pooping All Wrong Enough. And as you will see, yes, Dr. Trisha is a professor at Harvard with a weekly column in the Washington Post. Basically, she's super legit. You are going to learn so many fascinating things, including what is the secret of highly successful people. And yes, it might relate to your bowels. Just how bad do people perceive the experience of constipation? What actually is normal when it comes to your pooping habits? How should you poop in the bathroom? And should you actually get a bidet? I was kind of sold on bidets with this conversation, so I might be looking into that soon. The role of fiber in your bowel movements. How much do you actually need? And is going carnivore or super low carb a problem? The true cause of hemorrhoids. How to poop when you're traveling, and so much more. These show notes for today's episode will be at melanieavalon.com/poopingwrong. Those show notes will have a full transcript as well as links to everything that we talked about, so definitely check that out. I can't wait to hear what you guys think. Definitely let me know in my Facebook group, IF Biohackers, Intermittent Fasting plus Real Foods plus Life. Comment something you learned or something that resonated with you on the pinned post to enter to win something that I love. And then check out my Instagram, find the Friday announcement post, and again, comment there to enter to win something that I love. All right. Hi, friends. Did you know that one of our largest sources of toxic exposure each and every day is through our skincare and makeup? It is so frightening the effects these compounds can have on our health. So we put these products on to help us look better, and yet they actually can be aging us, contributing to health issues, fertility issues, thyroid issues, mood issues, and ready for something potentially even more shocking? A lot of these endocrine disruptors are actually obesogens, meaning they cause your body to gain weight and make it harder to lose weight. That's right, your skincare and makeup may be hindering your weight loss goals. Europe has banned thousands of these compounds, and the US has banned around a dozen. There's even a loophole from the 1960s that allows companies to put whatever they want in their products, and they don't even have to tell you. That's why I am overwhelmingly careful about the skincare and makeup that I use. But here's the thing, it can be hard to find skincare and makeup that is non-toxic and actually works. And then on top of that, that actually has all the products you need. I have found two companies, I am obsessed with their standards and use them every single day of my life and cannot recommend them enough. That's Counter, formerly known as Beauty Counter, and Crunchy. Both of these companies have incredible standards when it comes to what they put in their products. You can truly feel good about using them, and they actually work. For Counter products, go to melanieavalon.com/counter. And for Crunchy products, go to crunchy.com. That's crunchy.com/Melanie Avalon. New Crunchy customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off. You'll also receive something special from me after your first order. I also highly recommend joining both of their loyalty programs. It's completely free to join, and with every purchase, you'll earn credit as well as other fun goodies. For all the latest updates, new products, specials, deals, and fun things for me, because yes, I love giving things away, get on my email list. That's at Melanie. melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. You can also get text updates when you text skincare to 877-861-8318. That's skincare to 877-861-8318. So again, to shop with me and get a free gift from me after your first order, go to melanieavalon.com/counter and also crunchy.com/melanieavalon. And new customers use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 at Crunchy to get 10% off site-wide. And again, definitely join their free loyalty programs to earn credit on every order. Hey friends, exciting news. My Avalon X Spirulina is back in stock and now at a reduced price. Plus you get free shipping and my coupon code works on top of that sale price. Spirulina is honestly one of the most nutrient-dense things that you can put in your body in a whole foods, easy to eat form. It's a blue-green algae, which is a complete vegan protein packed with an incredible array of nutrients. We are talking 100% of your daily hard-to-get vitamin K, 625% of vitamin B12, over 1,000% of vitamin A, 86% of chromium, 27% of vitamin B2, plus so much more, including iron, GLA, the powerful antioxidant superoxide dismutase, and even glutathione. In fact, spirulina is so uniquely nutritious that it was actually studied by NASA to support the astronauts. I searched high and low to find the very best spirulina out there. Ours comes from a wonderful, sustainable, clean, environmentally friendly production facility in Hawaii. Not Thailand, Hawaii. And then on top of that, we did our own third-party testing for over 70 pesticides, heavy metals, toxins, all the things. This is the cleanest spirulina out there. And with spirulina, you can simplify your supplement routine and support your nutrition in one easy step. The tablets are super versatile. You can swallow them whole, blend them into smoothies, crush them up, or honestly, just eat them like I do. And again, we were out of stock, but now Avalon X Spirulina is finally back in stock at a reduced price, and my coupon code MelanieAvalon works on top of that too. Plus, you get free shipping. Just go to avalonx.us/spirulina and use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off our new reduced price plus free shipping. That's avalonx.us/spirulina with the coupon code MelanieAvalon. I think that's all the things. Without further ado, please enjoy this fabulous conversation with Dr. Tricia Pasricha. Hi, friends. Welcome back to the show. I am so incredibly excited about the conversation I'm about to have. It is on one of my favorite topics that I talk about all the time, probably more than most people, and with the most incredible guest and person to talk about this for their incredible book and all the things. So here is what we are doing. I am here with Dr. Tricia Pasricha. She is the author of a book called You've Been Pooping All Wrong, How to Make Your Bowel Movements a Joy. She is an associate professor of medicine at Harvard. She writes the Ask a Doctor columnist for the Washington Post, where she translates complex medical topics into must-read insights every single week. She is also a graduate of Harvard herself. She has a medical degree from Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, a Master of Public Health from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and she is currently a director at the Institute Institute for Gut Brain Research at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, and many, many more things. So that is a really, really impressive resume. And friends, oh my goodness. So as you guys know, I, for years and years and years, have talked about my own challenges and struggles with my bowel movements and all the things, be it constipation, IBS, my intrinsic fear that I actually have had about my bowel movements and obsession and fixation. And it's honestly the reason I started going to therapy, which is probably a good thing because most people can probably benefit from going to therapy. But in any case, I clearly was very excited about reading this book. And oh my goodness, it completely blew me away. So I learned so much that I had no idea about when it comes to how are our bowel movements actually work? What actually happens down there? The role of the, you know, conscious input from our minds versus what is kind of on autopilot, what we can control, what we can't control. Speaking of, there's a lot in the book about how to control things. If you have fears of pooping in public or with travel or whatever it may be, there's a ton of science. There's all the things about the gut-brain connection and how, you know, oftentimes we say that IBS is like all in your head, but is that true? Is it actually all in your gut? Like, where is it? Wiping habits. I cannot even properly summarize everything. So friends, I've just been looking forward to this conversation so much. I have so many questions. So Trisha, thank you so much for all that you do. Also, you have a really interesting backstory, so I want to get into that. And thank you so much for being here.
Oh my gosh, that was an amazing introduction. Thank you for having me, Melanie. I'm delighted to be here.
It's so funny. When I started reading your book, you know, you open by talking about your father, who was a famous gastroenterologist. Or does he still practice now?
He does. Yeah, he's at the Mayo Clinic right now.
Oh, yes. Okay. Amazing. Amazing. You talk about, you know, growing up, what was normal with like conversations around the dinner table. And I was just reflecting. I was like kind of jealous. I was like, I don't know, especially given my current fixation with all things bowel movements. I was like, what would that be like to like grow up with that sort of conversation happening all the time? And then your mom was in the FBI. Like, so I like so many things. I just have a really quick question, just a personal question. So did you, because I found for me, what happened with me was that I never thought about my bowel movements growing up, like at all, which is kind of similar to what you talk about in the book with, you know, I think you give an example of like a patient and you ask him like what his stool looks like or something. And he, you know, says he doesn't ever even look at it. I think a lot of people are like that. And then for me, I had this inciting incident where I got food poisoning. And then after that, things just never got back to normal. And that's when I became fixated. So my question here to like start it off is I kind of reflect fondly on the times when I didn't think twice about my bowel movements at all. It's like shocking to me because I switched into a state where I literally thought about it 24/7 to the point, like I said, that I started going to see a therapist for it. So with you growing up with that culture of your family, which I'd love to hear more about, did that make you at all, it's like a pun, like anal about your bowel movements. Like did that have a negative effect at all on any anxiety for you? Like, have you personally had bowel movement issues?
Yeah, that's a great question. We talked about poop all the time. So it was on my mind all the time. But I think the difference in what I think was positive and that I'm hoping to, you know, I have two kids, I have a 2-year-old and 4-year-old, is that we were just a really poop positive family. Like, it wasn't like discussed in a way that at least I didn't perceive as being overly intrusive, but it was intrusive, right? Like, it was like, you know, like my dad would ask us stuff like, did you go today? And, you know, like other dads might be like, did you do your homework? He was like, did you have a bowel movement? And we'd be like, yes or no. And if we said no, he'd be like, why? What went wrong? What's going on? But kind of like in just like a check-in, not in like a, you know, like shame on you, you should have pooped and you didn't, but more just like, what's going on? And it was very welcoming and open and eventually just talking like this all the time, we came to learn so much, not just about our bowel movements, but really if you get past the like, you know, like how silly and odd it is to talk about your poop, you kind of then get to open the door to talk about how cool and exciting the physiology of your gut is in general and how your body works. And all of those conversations happened most of my childhood. And I would say probably most of my childhood, I had a fantastic relationship with my bowels. I was very aware of it when I went to college. And like everything about being in college for me was new and stressful, and that relationship changed. And I, having grown up, like really, really having a particular pattern and knowing when something was off, I could feel that like things had changed. And I spent a lot of time trying to course correct afterwards. And then when I went on and eventually became a doctor on my own, that was like several years later, I mean, I did notice this bizarre pattern, like you're describing, that there are a lot of people who never talk about their bowels. They don't really think about them. And there's two camps. There's a camp that doesn't think about them, doesn't talk about them, and it's not a problem at all. But there's this second camp, which is the kind that I saw in my clinic, which is they don't talk about it, they don't think about it, and yet it's bothering them and it's disrupting their lives, even if they haven't quite made the connection. Like, so I'll give you a really specific example. Like, it's very common for me to have someone in clinic who's been like dragged in by their partner, for example, and like they'll say, "I don't think I have a problem." And their partner will be like, "Are you kidding me? You spend 40 minutes in the bathroom, or like you're always getting up to leave in the middle of the dinner table, or like we can't go on vacation because of this." And oftentimes it's like getting a partner, it's living with someone for the first time that makes you realize that this thing, this way of life that you had, which you thought was normal, you didn't think twice about it. Once you see how somebody else lives and you're like, you get really close to someone else, you realize that your bowel habits were disrupting your life. Like they were actually a bigger problem than you realized. You just didn't know because you never had a conversation with someone else and you never had like a third party to be like, wait, this is not how the rest of us are doing it. And so I had come across this statistic, which I still think about a lot, which is that 40% of Americans' daily lives are disrupted by their bowel habits. And that's not necessarily people who have a diagnosis of some kind, like not necessarily people with IBS, just something about their bowels disrupts their daily lives. It's a huge number. And I think if we were to go back to the root of how we got in that situation, it's largely because so many people don't talk about it. They don't, and they don't know who to talk about with it, and they don't know the words to use, and they don't have the conversation. So I am very much of the belief that like, I wish everybody grew up in the kind of household I grew up in where talking about it was not only normal, but it was like a healthy check-in. And then, and what I loved about my dad and that I hope I'm doing with my kids is that it was fun. Like, it's like, first of all, like poop jokes are like hilarious when you're 5 years old. Like my daughter loves these jokes, but also like, it's just cool to think about the science and to learn about it. And that's really what sucked me in into wanting to become a gastroenterologist. So I hope that all of us start talking about this more.
Oh my goodness. Okay. Well, I'm loving talking about it right now. So this is so great. Okay. I have 50 million things I want to ask you. So one question is, okay. So for example, your dad would check in, you know, asking you if you pooped that day. One of the things that was pretty mind-blowing to me and very comforting to me, because I think we have this idea in society like that there's the right amount of times to go, which is like maybe once per day. And yet you share some stats in the book, like the crazy range. So like Americans, anywhere from like 3 to 7 times a week is normal, but like in Eastern India, it's like 14 times a day. Or like, what was the other one? Italy is around 1 time a day. So this range of how many times we even go, which one of the things I really liked about the book is it's very comforting. Like it makes you feel okay about both identifying what maybe off in what you're doing or need to be addressed and fixed, while also being comforting about like it's okay if you're not like the picture perfect, you know, picture of normal, like it's going to be okay. If you have to take a laxative here and there, that's okay. But yeah, so what is normal?
Yeah, it's, you know, we have this idea that it normal should be one perfect sausage like stool every day. And that idea dates back centuries. Like I was going, when I was researching this book, I like went into these like pre-Civil War era medical manuals in the Harvard archives to try to figure out where this myth came from. And we were saying even back then, medical doctors were like, if you feel you need to have a bowel movement more than once a day, hold it in so that you can just have one nice formed one in the morning rather than like, God forbid, you have to poop twice in one day. And I see like echoes of this in clinic, like people will come in and say, I have to poop 3 times a day. I have diarrhea. And to me, that word diarrhea doesn't apply. If you're just pooping 3 times a day and you're happy and it doesn't really bother you, just like the frequency of 3 feels like it must be so much to a lot of people. But it's actually perfectly normal and natural because your body has these spikes. Your colon has these spikes throughout the day that during which it naturally is going to contract and try to have a bowel movement. And one of those times is when you eat, and we eat usually 3 times a day. And it's very normal for a lot of people to have to poop after they eat. Like within a couple minutes of your stomach stretching, we have these mechanical stretch receptors on the cells lining in our stomach, and that sends a signal up to the brain, which sends another signal down to the colon to start to contract. So this is very normal. But it's true that probably the strongest signal that we'll all have get during the day is within the first 1 or 2 hours of waking. And I think that that's how this myth took flight of like, have once daily evacuation every morning. That's the healthiest. That's the closest to God you'll ever get. And I think everyone has stuck with that since. And it's true that in the morning, there are a lot of these factors that kind of naturally could work together for people to have a good bowel movement. Like one is your colon goes to sleep at night. It works on this circadian rhythm. So it's actually very quiescent while we're sleeping. Nobody, unless you have a medical issue, wakes up to go poop. You wake up to pee all the time, or some of us do, but it's pretty rare for people to have to wake up to go poop unless there's something else going on. And that is because your colon really doesn't move much at night. But in the morning, it wakes up and it buzzes with activity, and you get these really strong contractions that don't quite happen again for you during the rest of the day, except for these few rare occasions, like if you were to eat again. But then maybe you might go for a walk in the morning, or you might have a cup of coffee. These things really strongly trigger contractions, and then you're stacking them on top of each other. It makes sense why you would want to go to the bathroom in the morning if you can make time for it. The problem is that so many of us don't make time for it. We don't budget time for it. And our mornings are totally chaotic and hectic. And we miss that window. And then it becomes very hard to set up a pattern and a kind of regular schedule, which really the colon is not like a lot of other organs in our bodies. It loves a schedule. And the colon is this creature of habit. You know, your heart's going to keep on beating throughout the day, 24 hours, really no matter what you're doing. It might slow down at night, but it's going and going and going. Your colon's not like that. It's like you. It's going to go to sleep and it's going to respond to these cues. So it's really important to go on a schedule. But all of this said, because all of our schedules are so different, it's totally normal to not be what you think is normal. You don't have to go once a day. You don't have to go once in the morning to be normal. Normal just has to be 2 things in my books. One of those things is it should be comfortable for you. You shouldn't strain. It should be effortless. That's one criteria. And then 2, it should occur at socially appropriate times. Like somebody who poops 3 times a day after every meal and doesn't bother them, doesn't bother their partner, doesn't disrupt their work, that's completely normal to me. But there might be another person who says, I'm mortified because I have to poop like in the middle of my soup at lunch and I don't go out with my friends. I cancel brunch plans because I'm so embarrassed. Then I would say that's not normal. And then we can think about how to help fix it. But it really depends on the individual.
I thought it was really helpful. You had these case study examples where you have a patient and then the question is like, do you find that person normal or not? And what was really interesting about it is it showed that normal is not always, you know, picture perfect normal. Cause like, I remember the very first one that I read, I was like, oh, she's going to say that that's not normal. But then it was like, no, this is like not like, this is a normal situation that you're describing of this person.
Yes. Yeah. How many of those did you get right? Did you agree with me?
I think after the first one, I was like, okay, wait, I'm picking up on this now. So I think I did better after the first one, but yeah. So I love this, what you're saying about how it's on a circadian rhythm and the importance of like budgeting time for that. Cause that's also speaking my language, because I literally plan in time for my bowel movements at the beginning of the day. Like it's like budgeted in. And if I have to like go somewhere and like leave early, like then I wake up earlier. So it's all part of my calendar.
I love that for you. And I love that for me. I do the same thing. I actually like think this is like the secret of highly successful people. I'm not kidding you. Like, you know, everyone's like, oh, highly successful people, they make their bed every day. No, I think they budget time to poop every day. But they're just, that's not the one that makes it to like Forbes magazine. But I think that's the secret. And I think you figured it out.
Oh, I would advocate for that. I believe that because I mean, for me, I do a intermittent fasting pattern. So I eat in the evening, like a very large meal. And then it seems like the majority of my bowel movement happens the next day at the beginning of the day. And then I don't go throughout the day because I'm not eating. So I really have to schedule in that time. Like it is scheduled. And if I can't schedule it, I will possibly like not go to the thing. Like if it requires, like if there's like something that's happening earlier and I know I can't schedule in that time, I might just not go. That's how much I do that.
Yeah. But you know, I think that that is natural and normal because your colon does become trained to respond to these external cues. And so like having that routine, doing it the same time, the same place, the same kind of comforts all around you, that's exactly how your colon thrives. Like people do not thrive when they go on vacation, you know, because when you throw your colon out of their routine, that's exactly why people go 4 or 5 days on vacation and don't poop. They don't talk about it as loudly as they should. But like what you're describing, this is exactly what I do too, is setting up a regular rhythm, that's the way that your colon is able to know it's time to go, and then it does. And then you don't have to worry about it the rest of your day.
Actually, so here's a question I'm thinking of, which is, so you said that and I do want to get more into the actual reflexes because there's a contradiction when it comes to, is it tension and contraction or is it relaxation? So we can get into that. But before that, you mentioned the circadian rhythm affecting the movement, the eating of food affecting the movement. Can you, if you, I guess, artificially induce a bowel movement, would that also signal back the rhythm to the colon? And what I mean by that is, for example, say you're traveling and so now you're in a new time zone, so the rhythm is off. For me, when I travel, the first thing I do the next day, unless I don't have to and it's just like, it just works out and for some reason my bowels are cooperating. But if they're not, I either do an enema, like I literally pack an enema bucket in my suitcase, or I'll get a colonic. Does doing an external instigation of the bowel movement tell, like reset the circadian rhythm of the bowel?
That's a good question. The things that actually probably most strongly, researchers found most strongly resets the circadian rhythm are the external cues like light. And so like melatonin plays a big role in the circadian clocks and also eating. So, you know, we don't eat at nighttime, and eating first thing in the morning is a strong cue to your colon that we're waking up, it's time to be active. And so those two things are most strong. Using a laxative, like a stimulant laxative or maybe an enema, those things will cause the colon to contract and it'll cause a bowel movement, but they don't actually necessarily set you up circadian wise for like the next day or the next 24 hours. You are probably doing that work yourself because you're staying up to kind of readjust to that time zone. But what I like to do when I travel is start to put myself in the mind, and I'm doing all of this for my bowels, like more so than I'm doing it for my energy level or for like anything else. I'm like, I just want to get this, you know, set. And I start to think and act and behave like I'm already in that time zone before my plane has taken off. Like if I'm going to Europe and I'm thinking, okay, it's 9 a.m. here, but it's 3 p.m. over there, I'm going to wait and eat, and I'm going to have dinner on the flight at like noon or whatever, at like 1 p.m. That's going to be my dinner, and I'm going to go to sleep soon afterwards. You know, I'm not going to like watch movies for the next travel. I'm going to put my like a light blocking mask on. I'm doing all of this, not just so that I can like have energy and be ready to go, but more like because I just want my colon to start reacting and behaving like it's on this new time zone, so we are ready to go. I mean, the other thing I do, which is I think even more important, or at least just as important, is I pack, just like you're packing like a colonic or something, I pack so much of my fiber supplement. I bring a fiber supplement along because I know when I go on vacation, I try to be good and I try to be really aggressive about eating more fiber than usual. And I think that's what we all should do. But sometimes it just doesn't happen. Like you're just like at these like, you know, like fabulous places. You don't feel like you want to eat like this nice kale salad when you're like, there's a bowl of pasta that you could be eating instead. So at least do the bare minimum and take a fiber supplement because you need a lot of extra help when you're on vacation because you're fighting all of these other things happening at the same time. You're probably not exercising the way you used to. I rarely drink coffee the same way that I do when I'm at home. Like my whole schedule's off. So you have to catch up somehow. The easiest way sometimes is to just boost your fiber intake.
Yeah. Hi, friends. I have very exciting news. So I know you guys already know and love Element and understand the importance of electrolytes for hydration, energy, focus, supporting your fasting, your workouts, all the things. Guess what? Element has a product that goes beyond electrolytes. What is it? Well, so I am very pro the benefits of caffeine. I love the cognitive benefits, the longevity benefits, and that said, I am a slow caffeine metabolizer, so I don't actually take in lots of caffeine. I've also learned that the form, dose, and balance of caffeine makes a huge difference in how you actually feel.
That's why I am so excited that Element has launched a brand new lemonade iced tea. It's refreshing, delicious, lightly caffeinated, perfect for summer. And what I really love is the science behind it. So instead of relying on massive amounts of isolated synthetic caffeine like so many energy drinks out there do, Element Lemonade Iced Tea uses a full black tea extract. So alongside the caffeine, you naturally get compounds like L-theanine and polyphenols. The L-theanine actually helps smooth out the stimulant effect for a calmer, steadier energy experience with less spikes and crashes, while the polyphenols provide antioxidant support as well. And you guys know I am all about the antioxidants. And the incredible team at Element, including my personal hero, Rob Wolf, conducted a meticulous amount of research to find the perfect amount of caffeine, which is the sweet spot for sustained focus and energy without feeling overstimulated or wrecking your sleep later. That is exactly 50 milligrams of caffeine. On top of that, they knew that caffeine can increase your need for critical minerals like sodium, potassium, and magnesium, so that's why Element Lemonade Iced Tea pairs the perfect amount of caffeine with a meaningful dose of electrolytes to support optimal hydration and performance. And of course, Element Lemonade Iced Tea is completely free of sugar, artificial colors, and all the other stuff that you do not want that are so commonly found in caffeinated drinks today. It's built on the same science-backed electrolyte formula that Element is known for, with sodium, potassium, and magnesium in ratios designed to support hydration and energy production. The result? You get your perfect pack of portable, easy-to-make lemonade iced tea that provides steady, clean energy that tastes delicious and actually feels good. As you guys know, Element is trusted by neuroscientists, functional medicine practitioners, professional athletes, including the NFL, the NBA, the NHL, and they're even used by Navy SEALs and the Marines. So are you ready to up your drink level with the ultimate lemonade iced tea? You can get it. And when you get it, get a free 8-count sample pack of Element's most popular drink mix flavors with any purchase at drinklmnt.com/Melanie Avalon. That's right, a free 8-count sample pack of Element's most popular drink mix flavors with any purchase at drinklmnt.com/Melanie Avalon. Find your favorite flavor or share it with a friend. And by the way, Element has an amazing no questions asked refund policy, so you can try it completely risk-free. If for any reason you're not satisfied, they will give you your money back. Again, go to drinklmnt.com/Melanie Avalon for a free 8-count sample pack of Element's most popular drink mix flavors with any purchase, including their new lemonade iced tea.
To that point, so the circadian rhythm with traveling, we actually have talked about this a lot on the intermittent fasting podcast because, like you mentioned, light and eating, resetting everything. They've actually, I don't know if you've read it, but they've actually done a really interesting study on using fasting to reset the circadian rhythm, because basically, similar to what you were saying, you can use it to like not eat while traveling and then eat in the time zone that you arrived in. So kind of similar to what you're doing, you're just doing it on the plane, and that is really effective for resetting the circadian rhythm. So I find for me, it's really helpful because since I, contrary to, I guess what maybe we might've done it all the time as hunter-gatherers, but I eat at night. So then when I travel, I don't eat until the night, the next day at the new place. And I find that really helps me pretty quickly reset, which is really helpful.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I also think if that's your routine, like if you want to stick to your routine at home, which always is the thing that your body is going to respond best to, then totally do what you're doing and try to recreate all of those patterns that you can, but just in the new place that you're in.
Yes. Love it. Definitely want to get back into fiber too. One other question about what normal is. So we talked about when is normal and how many times a day is normal. But you mentioned the Bristol chart, which I am very, very familiar with. For listeners, don't tempt me with a Bristol chart. But for listeners, it's basically a chart that shows, and most listeners have probably seen it like on the wall of a doctor's office or something, but it shows the different stool consistencies. And, you know, people say to aim for the middle numbers. So is that the same thing where everybody has different normals, or do we really need to be aiming for that like 3-4 like middle zone?
Yeah, that it's kind of a similar thing. Like some people, you know, on one end of the spectrum, you have these like really hard, tiny rabbit-like pellets. And on the opposite end of the spectrum, you have like pure soupy liquid. And I would say both of those extremes are not fun. I've never met anybody who has these like rabbit pebbles and enjoyed that poop. And similarly, I think if you're having like really, really watery diarrhea, that's not pleasant either. So it doesn't have to be a perfect snake-like sausage. There can be variation within there, but I do think you want to have some kind of consistency to it. But that said, there's a lot of leeway there. And what I tell people all the time, because one of the things as a gastroenterologist we're always counseling people on is to increase their fiber, is that when you start to do that, you're going to naturally start to poop more and it's going to be softer. It's going to be slightly more mushier than maybe what you're used to. And that's totally normal. It's not that like now suddenly you have diarrhea necessarily, unless you know, it's bothering you and you're becoming so bad that you're dehydrated, but it's really just a function of you eating more fiber. And then, and rather than look at that and say, oh gosh, this is diarrhea, this is a problem, say, wait, wow, this is great. This is a representation that I'm eating more fiber and it's reflecting back at me, and you should embrace that new you.
Yeah, it's interesting, at least for me, because I mentioned having like the gut issues started after the food poisoning, but I went through a period of time, I don't even know how long it was, but I was severely constipated. That's what started all my like neuroses around this, because I felt so toxic that I like developed a complex around it. And so now I find I'm much better with everything. That said, I find that so when I see that Bristol stool chart, I even get anxiety looking at the, like I err on the side of being more on the loose side, because I have such a fear of being constipated that any day I would rather be things moving. Like even if I have to go to the bathroom more, like I just am so averse to being constipated. I think you said something in the, did you say something about like a woman who had, she had some sort of tremors, I think. And she said that she would rather not be constipated. Like she would rather have her tremors than be constipated. And I was like, I know, I hear you. Like, so I guess what I'm asking is that a problem that I like encourage things to be more loose because I'm like so scared of being constipated?
No. Well, I think it sounds like you've had a long journey with this, and it's kind of a classic story that you've described in a way a lot of people have some infection, maybe it's viral, bacterial, we don't always quite know, but like food poisoning it's people estimate it's between 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 people who get food poisoning, like an infectious diarrhea, will go on to develop IBS. And depending on that person and their own neurons and what they're bringing to the table, it might be more on the constipation side, it might be more on the diarrhea side. So we see all of it, and being constipated is so miserable. It's like truly one of the most miserable, I think, human experiences. And it's really underappreciated. It's not just me saying that or you saying that. It's there in the literature that like people with Parkinson's disease, which is something I study, if you survey them, they would rather give up their Parkinson's tremors then live with that severe constipation. And in IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, I mean, researchers have asked people who have IBS, like, what would you give up? People would give up sex in order to be able to have good bowel movement. That's how intense this is. And so but for something that we don't talk about, we feel embarrassed to talk about out loud. So I can understand entirely why you would never want to be feeling constipated again, and you would rather err on the side of loose stools. And I think, again, it's what's comfortable for you. There are some people who would rather have a harder, firmer stool. And as long as they're not straining too hard and it doesn't bother them, and that's what they're comfortable with, I can live with that. I can live with a whole range of normal, as long as generally people's habits are healthy and don't interfere with their enjoyment of their daily life.
Which is what you call, I haven't said the word out loud, so poopphoria, I guess is the word.
That's right. Poopphoria. That's exactly what I want everyone to live and experience.
So that's having comfortable movements and having socially appropriate movements.
Yeah. And just not thinking about them. But I want you to not think about them and truly be living a life where they're not bothering you. Your bowel movements are not this thing that like weighs you down because you haven't gone that day, or you're like not joining your friends when they're all going out. You can't go and take a new class that you want to take because of this. It should just be something that happens effortlessly, quickly, however many times a day it happens for you. And then you go live your best life.
I love this. I love this. And actually, okay, so because we're talking all about, you know, a person's perception, okay, a person's bowel movements and what's normal, and then their perception and experience of that. And something I found so fascinating in your book, and it was something I was a little bit aware of, but I hadn't read I hadn't learned about the actual studies on it, which was, I remember, you know, being told that for people who oftentimes who experience bloating, for example, who say they experience bloating, that they'll do tests and they're not technically like any more bloated than other people who are not feeling the bloating. And I remember when I first heard that, I was like, well, that's upsetting because I do feel bloated. So don't tell me it's like all in my head. And then you talk about these studies where basically the people who are experiencing that, like they are feeling it more than the other people, right? Like they are actually feeling it more. So, but it's your brain perceiving it. So what's happening there? So when people who seem to be hypersensitive to what's happening inside, what's the cause of that? Is that coming from their intestines? Is it coming from their brain? Like, why?
Yeah. In the bigger picture, when we talk about irritable bowel syndrome and or bloating or a lot of these disorders, sometimes they get framed as a problem of how the gut and the brain communicate. And that's what I study. And I think if you just leave it there, that sounds really, really vague. And it's very, very confusing. And it's kind of this like way that I think a lot of people say, oh, okay, this is about my brain, therefore maybe it's all in my head. And all these tests are often normal too, right? Like we'll do colonoscopies, we'll get biopsies, and these things are all normal. And once we start to invoke the brain in the conversation, it becomes very easy for people to say, okay, well, it's because this person is stressed, and often that person is a she, and she needs to take some anti-anxiety medicines or something like that. And what's interesting is that if you dive deeper into the chemical and the molecular mechanisms about what happens with our perceptions of pain and discomfort and hypersensitivity, like you mentioned, they have to start somewhere, but by definition, they also have to pass through the brain, or we wouldn't perceive anything as uncomfortable if that signal didn't eventually reach the brain. And in the case of irritable bowel syndrome, sometimes the signal goes awry at multiple different levels. There's a problem with the nerves in the gut. And remember that the gut has millions of neurons or nerve cells, just like we have in our brain, but they're spread out through our colons, our small intestines, our stomachs, and we call that network the enteric nervous system. And what we think happens is there's some often inciting event or maybe a series of inciting events. Oftentimes, it happens early on in life. It's a classic scenario is someone says there was some traumatic, either physically traumatic or maybe emotionally, psychologically traumatic event early in childhood. Or perhaps there's an inciting event like you've described in your case, which we see very commonly, like a big infection. And maybe it doesn't even feel so big to you at the time. Like with COVID, we had a lot of mild cases where they were like, yeah, I felt like a mild cold, but then that's what triggered IBS. So some inflammatory event or trigger happens. And those nerve cells that are in our guts become sensitized, meaning it takes a lot less going forward for them to react. And when this happens earlier on in life, it's partially because those nerve cells haven't yet formed and fully matured. And so they start to then say, this is the new normal. This is the level at which we should react. But when you're older, it can still happen as well. And those nerve cells then will start to react even to normal types of movements that happen within our body all the time that we don't think about, that for other people is just the sensation of gas passing through the body or food that's on its way. Most people don't feel those things, but you, if you have IBS and your nerve cells are reacting at a much lower threshold, you're going to feel all of those movements. And it's going to be very uncomfortable to have a bowel movement where you're pushing a lot of stool out. And that signal of something triggering those nerve cells then has to go through your spinal cord up to your brain, and your brain perceives it as painful. And then oftentimes what happens is, especially in these chronic conditions with like IBS, you get triggered enough all the time, multiple times a day, that of course it makes you hypervigilant. It makes you worried about your symptoms. It makes you worried, when is this next trigger going to come? And you start to say, I never want to live like this again. You start to, you know, as you describe, you start to fixate on your bowels. And then somebody from the outside just comes and looks at you and they're like, wow, this person, all she does is think about her bowels. That's the reason she has symptoms, because she's thinking about them too much, right? And it looks like the problem is in your head, when that is not the case at all. It's started inside your gut, and it just formed this vicious cycle that cannot be detected on standard tests, but has been detected. We know how to detect it through special stains and looking for the right types of nerve cells, but it's just not something that we do in a typical colonoscopy, but we know it's there.
Wow. Okay. Yes. I find this very validating from my experience. Although, important clarification, because I realize I say that I have IBS. However, and you're talking here about nerve cells and you mentioned the word pain, I remember, didn't they change the definition of IBS a few years ago, where prior to that, and I could be wrong, but prior to that, it did not include having to have pain, and then it did. Is that I just know that. So I actually don't have pain. I just have bowel. And like I said, I manage it pretty well, but I have what I consider to be IBS, and that I feel like it's not euphoria. Like, it's not like the, you know, effortless, easy bowel movement, but I don't actually have pain. I just have like distress over bloating. So does that technically not qualify as IBS?
I will say, I think all of these conditions are on a spectrum, and how we define IBS based on symptoms does change every couple of years. And that's like a whole separate conversation. But yes, at one point it usually does involve discomfort or pain to be called IBS. And at one point we were saying it has to be pain or discomfort that's relieved with the bowel movement. Now we're saying it's pain or discomfort associated with the bowel movement before, after, during, like any kind of link to bowel movements. And we're actually going to change the definition probably sometime next year. So we might throw all of that out the window. I know.
To what?
I don't know. Like the gods that be, the powers that be are going to change it. But I think to me, how we change it based on people describing their symptoms isn't, and then there's bloat, and then there's like a cousin of IBS, which we might call functional bloating, which is more about the, focuses more on the bloating symptoms, but they're all very closely linked. And people with IBS often have a lot of bloating. People who have a lot of bloating often struggle with their bowel habits, even if technically the criteria don't overlap. So to me, all of these words and the names of the disorders are less helpful than understanding the pathophysiology and meaning what is happening at the level of the nerve cells, what is happening molecularly. And that's not how we're clinically defining these conditions yet. But I think in the next 10 years, we're going to see a shift where we're going to be able to start changing and defining them really based on what's actually going on, not just based on, in the last 3 months, did you think your bowel movements were associated with more bloating than discomfort? Like, when these two things are on a spectrum, and they're going to change with time, and we're even changing the definition with time.
Okay, gotcha. So actually that's kind of similar, because, and you have this list of, you know, common myths, and one of them was, you know, that there's a single definition for constipation, for example, but, you know, people define it all different ways. Speaking of the fiber, so I'm always really interested to learn about, you know, what the recommendations are for, you know, increasing bowel movements or optimizing bowel movements. And you mentioned fiber and psyllium husk specifically. And I know, so for me, when I was in my constipation dark phase, I definitely went through a period where I was like, okay, try all the fiber. So I definitely tried psyllium husk, but I also tried it in a time when I was trying a lot of different fibers and nothing was working. So I kind of wrote it off. And I also kind of got a fear of fiber, because my experience was that, okay, I'm like eating all this fiber and nothing's coming out. So that's just kind of, that's like, that's what was so traumatic to me. So is there something magical about psyllium husk compared to other fiber types? And what is the role of it in supplemental form versus having like a high fiber diet from like Whole Foods?
Hey friends, I'm about to tell you how to get 10% off the ideal coffee when it comes to supporting your health. So if you guys know me, you know I am obsessed with optimizing basically everything I consume, and that especially relates to coffee. Did you know that coffee is one of the most powerful sources of antioxidants in the modern diet? And yet, not all coffee is created equal. Between sourcing, farming practices, roasting, and contaminants, there can be a huge difference in the health impact of the coffee that you drink. That is exactly why I created Glow Coffee. Glow Coffee is a premium, specialty-grade Arabica coffee sourced from sustainable women-led farms in Colombia. It's organically grown, and we third-party test it meticulously, like every single lot, for purity. And what makes Glow especially exciting from a biohacking perspective is that we specifically made it to be rich in chlorogenic acid, or CGA. That's one of coffee's primary, most potent antioxidant compounds that has been studied for its role in metabolic health, inflammation, oxidative stress, and so much more. The elevation levels of the beans, how they're grown, and how they're roasted all affect CGA levels. So we searched high and low to find the perfect beans naturally high in CGA and tested them to confirm that, and then we roast those beans to preserve the CGA content. And then test after that as well. Coffee is already one of the potentially biggest contributors of antioxidants in the human diet, so I designed Glow Coffee to maximize those benefits while keeping it incredibly clean and high quality. And this coffee is so clean. It's grown organically, of course, but then we go even farther than that. We third-party test the beans for almost 100 toxic compounds, including pesticides, heavy metals, and mold. Oh, and perhaps the best part is it is absolutely delicious. We're talking smooth, low bitterness. It's honestly the exact coffee I personally want to drink every single day of my life. It's so bright, smooth, and delicious that it's also perfect black for fasting. No added sweeteners or cream needed. You can also splash it on your face for an antioxidant-rich toner. I do that every single day. After the sauna, after the shower, all the things. I created Glow Coffee because it's really about upgrading one of our most common daily habits into something that truly supports your health and performance. You can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. That's 10% off Glow Coffee with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. Are you ready to glow inside and out? Fuel your day, illuminate your way. That's glowcoffeeco.com.
Well, the shortest answer to that is that it is always better to get your fiber through Whole Foods than it would be through any like one source like psyllium husk. And that's because, as you know, as everyone knows, that there's more to constipation, there's more to healthy bowel habits than just fiber. Fiber plays such a big role, but it's really all these other phytonutrients that work together in these combinations that you just can't necessarily distill. But all of that said, if you're not meeting your fiber goals through your diet, which 95% of us aren't, I mean, I take a psyllium husk supplement every day for the days that I don't make it. And I try really, really hard to exceed those fiber goals. But if I don't, then I know I have this. And what makes psyllium husk special is that it's basically, it should just be this ground up powder. I look for forms that just have like this one ingredient, just the psyllium. And it's a soluble fiber, which means that you have to drink it in liquid, like at least 8 ounces of water. I'm a little odd. I put it in my coffee. I don't necessarily recommend that for everyone because you have to chug that coffee or it will turn into a gel. That's what it does, is it's a soluble fiber, so it turns into a gel. And it's that gel that you want it to turn into when it hits your small intestine, because that gives you two things. It can kind of add bulk to your stool. It can loosen it up, soften it, and make it easier to pass through. But also if you have diarrhea, it can also kind of pull it together and hold it together and actually conform it. So it's kind of this shapeshifter, and it actually helps for people who have diarrhea. It helps for people who have more constipation. And it does something else too, which is that because it's a soluble gel, it can help lower the cholesterol levels in your body because it traps bile salts, which are produced by your body. And then your liver has to create more of them, and it draws cholesterol out of your bloodstream to do that. So it's great for your heart. But then what's interesting is that as that stool that has the psyllium passes along through your small bowel and out makes its way into the colon, psyllium is one of those prebiotics that your microbes really like to feed on and ferment. And why psyllium seems to work well in conditions like IBS or other types of conditions is partially because of what it seems physically to be doing to your stool form, but partially also probably because of what happens when the microbes ferment it. So the idea is that when the microbes ferment psyllium, they're producing certain kinds of short-chain fatty acids that seem to change the properties of the nerve cells right there in the colon. And it seems to raise the sensitization levels, and it seems to change how they react then to other inputs. So you do get this physical change in your stool when you have psyllium husk, but then you get these other benefits that take a little bit more time to work. but that seem to do with these anti-inflammatory properties and possibly related to neuroinflammation even within the gut itself.
I love this. I've been going down a rabbit hole with short chain fatty acids. I think that's going to become something that we hear more and more about, just as how, you know, how they function as signaling molecules for so many things in the body. So, okay, I love that. What do you think about it's funny because there's an entire carnivore movement, you know, zero carb, where people are just eating meat essentially, which I actually did do for quite a while. They all reference this one study that it has like 8 people in it, but it's like the study they use to show that a zero carb diet is ideal for bowel movements. Because basically in the study, it was like, and it's been a long time since I've read it, but I've read it so many times because it's always referenced, but it's, you know, like just a handful of people, but they all had constipation, functional constipation, and then it resolved completely when they went on a zero carb diet. So, well, probably carb, but zero fiber diet. So what do you think about that? People who are doing like carnivore, not having any fiber, if they're not experiencing, you know, bloating or pain or a perception of bowel movements being an issue, how do you feel about that, people living that lifestyle?
Yeah, it's really popular. Like I see this, people come to my clinic often too, like this carnivore diet is popular. And what I would say is that it's true that when people eat a lot of fiber, and especially if they're not used to it or they're like kind of ramping it up a little quickly, people often feel ill because fiber is going to cause bloating. It can sometimes cause a little bit of loose stools or what people perceive as diarrhea. And you take that out and people often feel better in the short term. And even the bowel habits, it's hard to say whether they had constipation because of anything to do with fiber. Like we've hinted at, constipation can be due to low fiber intake, and sometimes that's a fix, but it's not the only fix and it's not the only cause. And we know so many people, a lot of people probably listening, who have tried intaking their fiber and ramping up their fiber intake and it didn't fix it. So in the case of this study, it's hard to know whether fiber really actually was anything related to why those people had constipation. But the problem is that if you eat these types of diets, in the short term, you may feel better, you may enjoy it, you may have, you know, no symptoms from it. But in the long term, there's a real concern about the kinds of damage that you might be doing to your gut lining and to the kinds of microbes that inhabit your gut. And, you know, we talk a lot about this in the gastroenterology literature. Probably, I imagine probably everybody can agree that processed meats are something that we know is very pro-inflammatory. When I tell my patients that, you know, even red meats, like, you know, like, yes, even the organic grass-fed beef, these foods have shown this signal in epidemiological studies to be linked to an increased risk of colon cancer. Maybe not to the same degree, certainly not to the same degree as processed meats, but the signal is there and it's been repeated multiple times. That's a hard message to hear because, like, you know, we all love red meats in this country, and it's like a big part of, it's a dietary staple. It's like, you know, everybody gets around for barbecues in the summer. It's kind of part of the culture. And it's hard to take that away, especially now with the carnivore movement being on such a rise. But I worry about this, one, because we're seeing such a rise in early onset colorectal cancer cases that worries me every single day, to be honest. I see this in my own clinic. And while those cases are not only being driven by higher red meat intake or processed meat intake, it's part of it. It's like part of the problem. It's a problem that we can identify and recognize. So I try to counsel people, not necessarily to say never eat red meat again, like by no means, but just to try to limit it to no more than maybe 3 servings a week, which is a big deal for a lot of people who are used to eating, you know, like a lunch meat sandwich every day, for example, or people on that. So it doesn't have to be all or nothing by any means. But for me, the data is convincing enough that, and I don't fully abstain from meat either. I'm not vegan necessarily or vegetarian. I eat red meat from time to time, but I don't eat more than 3 servings per week, mainly because I find that data so convincing.
Wow. Okay. Do you know the like the Inuit? I guess they would be the population that would be closest to eating like a primarily like meat and fat diet. I know they get a lot of the diseases of modern civilization when they adopt a Western diet, but do you know if they have any colon cancer before they switch over to modern?
That's a great question. I do know that in minority populations, there often is a higher rate of cases of colon cancer, but sometimes it's more of a detection issue. So actually, it's a good question. I'd have to look into it.
And also, just while we're talking about the fiber, did you see that study? When did this come out? Maybe a year and a half ago or so. It was the one that was looking at fiber versus fermented foods.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering if you had thoughts on it, because it basically found that fermented foods, you know, seem to have a beneficial effect, but not necessarily fiber when people, you know, added it supplementally to their diet. Or I think it was like a high fiber diet versus like a high fermented food diet.
The study I'm thinking of, and you can tell me if this is the same one that you are, there was a study that came out of Justin Sonnenberg's lab at Stanford where they had two groups who were both eating high fiber, but one of the groups were also told to eat fermented foods. Is that the study you were thinking about?
Maybe. What were the findings of it?
The findings were, and I think they did it for about 8 to 10 weeks, something of that time frame, where they told that second group, just increase your fermented food intake as however you can, as much as you can. And at the end of that study, they found that the group that had been eating more fermented foods had lower inflammatory markers in their blood.
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I talk about that study. If that's the same one, I do talk about that study often as a way to say that, you know, the first, like, I think the introductory course that I give my patients who are meeting me is let's just ramp up fiber intake however we can, because that is the number 1 and 2, 3 thing that we're probably not getting enough of in our diets. That's what I see very commonly. And it's true. Most people don't get enough. But if you want to take it to the next level, then the like 102 level course is, I say, let's start to increase the diversity of fiber and plant-based sources in our diet. So rather than, you know, just eating the same foods every day or just taking one psyllium husk supplement, now it's time to say, what are all the different whole food sources I can get and try to optimize that? And then the third thing I do is fermented foods. Fermented foods, largely because of that study and those findings, they independently have extra added beneficial properties, because the fermented foods by definition are introducing new live cultures that we believe are to some extent taking hold in our microbiome and helping repopulate those and generate positive growth. And fermented foods are great. They're also like something that a lot of people are just very unfamiliar with eating on a regular basis. And so it's often like not the first thing. If we can focus on anything, I say, let's just meet our fiber goals. But then if you're ready for it, I love eating fermented foods. And it's as simple sometimes as like just introducing like Greek yogurt like once a day. Like it doesn't have to necessarily be sauerkraut or kimchi, although I love all those things. It's kind of an acquired taste. Like eventually you start to really like the tang of those things. But I actually think like Greek yogurt is the simplest and best like gateway fermented food.
Yeah, I've been getting more and more into it, especially learning more and more about the short chain fatty acids. And my theory is that based on a person's, you know, foundational gut microbiome, like whatever they have at that moment, they might struggle with processing fiber. So I feel like people who have a gut microbiome that's like ready to go and process the fiber, like it's great. But for some people, they might just like struggle with digesting the fiber. And so I feel like the fermented foods are a way to, you know, gently nudge your gut microbiome that way without necessarily like hitting it with at least at once, you know, a lot of fiber at the beginning.
I think it's a very common thing I hear is when we're talking and counseling people to ramp up their fiber, it's like, it's uncomfortable to do that. Like you get bloated, you get sick, and that's very common reaction. And I love the idea of saying, okay, let's just like work on this adjacent pathway of introducing probiotics or fermented foods. But even with fiber, I've never seen anyone go from like 0 grams of fiber to like 25 a day daily without paying for it. Like you have to go low and slow and you have to work your way up, because it really does take several weeks for your gut microbes to react and adjust and repopulate. And that's, so it's not like within 24 hours, you're going to suddenly like become accustomed to a ton of fiber at once. Nobody could handle that. You have to go slow, real slowly with your body and kind of like let your symptoms guide you.
And to that point, the life experience moment that convinced me, like I'll never look back, that so much of our stool is bacteria or related to bacteria, you know, compared to the actual like food substrates, which was, I got prescribed VSL number 3, that probiotic, which is like very, very, it's like a lot of bacteria probiotics in there. And I took it, and the amount, I actually stopped taking it because the amount of stool it made me produce at the beginning, I was probably supposed to stay on it, but it freaked me out so much that I was like, whoa. I was like, okay, so a lot of stool is bacteria. I now know this for sure after taking this probiotic.
I know. Isn't that wild? Like we think that it's all just like whatever we haven't digested, but no, it's mostly your microbes that are just like living and dying in there and shedding themselves off.
Mm-hmm. So going to the actual, because, you know, the title, you've been pooping all wrong. So you have a very extensive overview of the actual mechanics of how we have bowel movements and toilet habits, things like that. So, well, this book has affected me beneficially in so many ways. And one of the ways it's affected me now is I'm literally thinking about when I have a bowel movement. Can you talk? Okay, I'll just ask the question. Can you talk a little bit about like the internal versus external sphincter and the role of what is consciously controlled versus what isn't? And then also, so are we contracting and creating tension, or is it relaxation? It's quite a paradox.
It's such a paradox. And I think this is a big underappreciated part of why some people get constipation is actually a muscular problem. And really by that, I mean a pelvic floor problem. So what happens in order to have a bowel movement, we all are very familiar with this, we have to generate what we call a Valsalva maneuver, which is where we bear down. Like we try to basically breathe against this closed glottis. Like we shut our mouths, but we kind of exhale. And that generates pressure in our chest cavity, which gets kind of translated downwards and helps, in theory, push your stool out. Well, right now, if I were to demonstrate doing that, like even my fists clench, because that's what you're doing. You're generating pressure and you're trying to push this poop out. And that's really odd when you think about the fact that in order to have a bowel movement, you have to relax your sphincters. And yet you're clenching other parts of your body. And what we often see happen is sometimes someone might become constipated for some reason early on in their life. Like for me in college, like maybe I wasn't eating enough fiber and I become constipated. And when that happens, you're not eating enough fiber, you train yourself that you have to strain a little bit harder in order to have a bowel movement. And you do that day after day, week after week, week after week. Eventually, those muscles in your pelvic floor start to change a little bit. And some of those muscles you don't have control over, because like for your anal sphincters, by the way, you have two, you have an external and an internal. You think it's one, just from the outside, it looks like just like one little butthole, but you have two, and you and I can consciously clench that external one and it'll kind of shut everything. But the internal one we have less control over. And that's the one that sometimes becomes overwhelmed and gives up. And like sometimes people have accidents. Sometimes it decides, I'm too nervous, I'm not going to open up. Even though we're like, we really need to go, we need to let this poop out. If that internal sphincter doesn't feel safe, it doesn't relax. And this is a problem because if we've trained these muscles incorrectly, maybe because of some lifestyle we had in our past, even when we fix that problem, now the muscles have become retrained. So even if I've discovered a plant-based diet later in my life, I'm eating a ton of fiber, the stool is very, very soft. Now my sphincters are working against me no matter what I'm bringing to the table. And so sometimes people benefit from maneuvers that are seeking to intervene on different parts of the pelvic floor. And sometimes as extreme an intervention as physical therapy for the pelvic floor. And that is actually something that about 1 in 3 people who have constipation that has not responded to laxatives, the issue the whole time is the pelvic floor. And that what they really would benefit from is something like pelvic floor physical therapy. And that's a huge number if you think about it, 1 in 3, because 1 in 3 people, I mean, constipation is very common. 1 in 3 people are not thinking about the pelvic floor as being an issue at all. It's something that, like, I think a lot of times when I say, oh, you may have pelvic floor dysfunction in clinic, a lot of people, especially the men, are like, wait a minute, how can that be? I never had kids. Everyone thinks pelvic floor dysfunction is like a problem that women get when they have children. And that is a kind of pelvic floor dysfunction, but this is very different. You don't have to be a woman to have it. You don't have to have had kids to get it. We can get it for any number of reasons. But, you know, the good news is that it is treatable, but sometimes it's just something that develops over time because of this like just bizarre paradoxical motion that has to happen at the sphincters, which is in stark contrast to the rest of what our bodies are doing.
Hi, friends. Did you know there is an ancient botanical that modern research shows performs on a level comparable to metformin when it comes to supporting healthy blood sugar levels? And not only that, this compound also supports the gut microbiome, healthy cholesterol levels, and even stimulates the AMPK pathway in the body to support cellular cleanup and longevity. You might have heard about AMPK. We talk about it a lot in the context of fasting, which also stimulates it. I am talking about berberine. I take berberine every single day of my life, and I see massive differences on my CGM, my continuous glucose monitor, when I use it. I take it to support my fast and before meals to reduce blood sugar levels. It is a powerhouse of a compound. And like I said, people are prescribed the pharmaceutical metformin to control their blood sugar levels when they could be taking this completely natural compound that has been used for thousands of years in both ancient traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine. I wanted to make the best berberine on the market, so that's why I created AvalonX Berberine 500. We did so much testing to find the most potent, pure, and clean form available. There's no problematic fillers, no common allergens, just pure, vegan, lab-tested berberine extracted from traditional sources. Friends, I am not kidding the difference I see on my blood sugar levels with this berberine. We're talking no post-meal spikes when I eat all that fruit and lower fasting blood sugar levels. It also reduced my HbA1c and my cholesterol levels. You can get it at avalonx.us. And the coupon code IFPODCAST will get you 10% off. You can also get a one-time 20% off coupon code when you text AvalonX to 877-861-8318. That's AvalonX to 877-861-8318. And you can get a 15% off coupon code by signing up for email updates. For that, just go to avalonx.us/email list. Again, friends, this is one of the most powerful compounds you can add into your health and wellness routine. Healthy blood sugar control, even if you're not pre-diabetic or diabetic, is so important, and berberine helps support that. It is the ultimate compound for blood sugar control, cholesterol, your gut microbiome, and longevity. Get it at avalonx.us with the coupon code IFPODCAST.
So fascinating to me. So it's kind of like two doors, and the first door the body controls more, and the second door we can physically shut if the first one opens.
Yes, exactly. Because sometimes you feel like this will happen to all of us at some point in our lives, if not already today. At some point, you might have to go to the bathroom, and it happens just at an inopportune time. And what that feeling is that you're like, what is this urgency? That's literally just your colon, the last part of your colon contracting. And if you try hard enough, you squeeze that external sphincter closed, it will shut the internal sphincter too. It'll overcome it because the external sphincter is a little beefier, and it'll shut it. And eventually, most of the time, it'll stop your colon from contracting. Your colon will say, okay, I get it. I see what you're doing. I'm going to stop. But every now and then, the internal sphincter puts up a big enough fight and it tries to let it, and then, you know, like then accidents happen. And it happens is more and more often as we get older, because partially because our external sphincters become a little bit weaker as we age. And then eventually we're not able to hold things back as much. I know this is like not the fun part of this conversation in our life, but that's what happens. And in a way, it's a good thing. The internal sphincter is very closely connected to our hemorrhoids, which are just these cushions of veins. And I mean, it's a very sophisticated part of our anatomy, because those hemorrhoids, which are like right there by that internal sphincter, they're also what's responsible. Like, they're not just like these evil red, puffy, angry cushions that bleed. They do that too when they become inflamed, but they also are there to just sense what's going on inside the bottom of our colons. They sense if we have poop sitting there. They sense if we have liquid in there or gas. And they're what subconsciously triggers us to know. I mean, how do we know that it's safe to pass gas when we're sitting in a crowded room? We know it because there are these sensors on those hemorrhoids and our internal sphincters that detect that it's gas and that it's not solid. And it says, okay, yeah, this is an okay time to do this. And you're able to do it without accidentally like pooping your pants in front of a meeting.
Question about the hemorrhoids, which leads to a broader question as well, which was, I found it really interesting. You were saying in the book that historically we thought hemorrhoids were from a lack of fiber. Then they were saying it's actually from straining. But then you did a study with your own patients where you looked at their habits and you found that like being smartphone use was correlated to it. So maybe it's like a time thing, like how long you're actually on the toilet. So my big question here is, so out of all those options, maybe what's going on with hemorrhoids? And then the broader question is, because earlier in the book, you talk about how it can be beneficial, for example, to like read a book on the toilet, like that can help people go sometimes. So I'm confused, or I'm interested and curious about the amount of time on the toilet. And if it's spent like reading a book, is that beneficial? But if you're on your phone, is it not? Like, what is the role of time on the toilet?
Yeah, totally. I think the common denominator here is time. I think time is one of the most important factors to consider. I do think fiber intake and straining play a role, but I think in our modern era, we are just all of us spending so much time more than we intended in the bathroom because our smartphones are so distracting. Like 20 years ago, like when I was growing up and they had, you know, like everyone remembers when people used to keep this like stack of old magazines in the bathroom that were like 2 months old, or like maybe yesterday's newspaper, you already knew what happened in the news and you're just reading to like kill a minute or two.
I had a book that I only read on the toilet. And so like, I would like read it then.
The bathroom reader. Yeah, exactly. I had the same, like we had these like predictable reading materials. Like we had a comic book, like the Far Side comic was like the ideal bathroom reader. But these things would just like occupy you. You could just flip through the pages, help you relax a little bit. And I do think, I mean, relaxation is critical to a bowel movement because you have to relax those sphincters. You have to be relaxed. You have to have this wave of your vagus nerve kind of simulating these contractions. And if you don't get that, it's very hard to go. So you need that. And so I think like if you want to pull out a quick read, be my guest. But it's when you pull out your smartphone and you get really distracted by this endless stream of TikToks and reels and you lose track of time and it's like 20 minutes later, that's when it becomes a problem. And it's just happening to all of us more than we, you know, like to admit. But most of us are bringing our smartphones in. That's what my study shows. And like anecdotally, like who's not bringing their smartphone in? And all I tell people is like, look, I'm not trying to take your smartphone away from you when you go to the bathroom, but just set like a 2 TikTok limit and then just check in with yourself. Like say, am I even focused on what I came in here to do? Or am I fully focused now? I'm like, you know, on this 4th like Bridgerton trailer and I should just get up and I should just go watch it on the couch, like rather than sit here with my pants down and keep doing what I'm doing. And all it takes is to just check in with yourself. But it's really what we think is happening with the time is that when you sit on a toilet bowl, like you have no pelvic floor support, right? It's just like this open donut. And like I said, hemorrhoids are just these cushions of veins. And eventually when they become, we all have them, they're sitting there. But when they become engorged, when blood starts to fill them more and more, eventually they can puff out and become irritating and painful. And with time, with just this like passive pressure of not having that pelvic floor support, if you do this day after day, maybe multiple times a day, but week after week, that connective tissue around the hemorrhoids we think weakens and eventually those veins engorge and bulge. And then that's why we saw this association with people who have spent longer time, people who bring their smartphones in, they spend more time in the bathroom and they were more likely to have hemorrhoids.
So fascinating. And then speaking of so other bathroom habits, and you have a whole section on, you know, how to go in the toilet, which I had no idea that. So wait, the guy who invented the toilet, his last name was Crapper, right?
He was one of the pioneers and marketed the toilet like around World War II era in England. And his name was like printed on the backs of all of the toilets. And we think that that's the origin of the famous moniker.
Okay, because it was Thomas Crapper. Oh no, that's TC, not TP, which your initials are TP. And you mentioned that in the book. Was that on purpose?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it was. Like, I think you are destined for greatness when your initials are TP and your dad's a gastroenterologist.
Speaking of, though, the habits that people have in the bathroom, and listeners, just go get You've Been Pooping All Wrong now, because it has literally guides to everything. So how to go to the restroom, you know, in your own bathroom, how to do it in public, traveling, if you're exercising, all the things. It's in there. One of the things I find really, really helpful, and I was glad that you endorse it, is the idea of, you know, raising up your legs. So like I used to have the actual official like squatty potty. Now I have some off-brand one. But if that, just like that simple adjustment is so helpful for me when I use the restroom. And even when I travel, here's my hack for people traveling. Cause you mentioned like, you know, even elevating your legs, even if you're not at home. I have found that usually in the majority of hotels I stay in, like the little trash can in the restroom is usually the perfect size. So here's what I do is I bring a roll of like small trash bags and I just use those. It actually makes it a lot easier to like keep the room clean. And then I like flip over that trash can and I use that to rest my legs on when I go to the restroom. And it works so well.
Oh my God. I love that travel hack. you're totally right that like even for people who would consider themselves healthy, normal bowel movements don't identify as having constipation. They've done these studies where they found that when you raise your knees above the level of your waist, everybody finds that they poop more easily. And that's totally expected because we have this, speaking of the pelvic floor, we have this other muscle in that pelvic floor called the puborectalis muscle, which is like this sling that basically chokes the tube of your colon closed. It's like your body stepping on its own hose and creating this kink. And that kink is there when we're sitting, like I am right now. I'm sitting at this 90-degree angle on my chair. And that could be, in theory, a good thing when you're just like sitting in meetings, going about your day. You don't actually, like it helps to have a little bit of extra closure there. However, when you go to the bathroom, you want that tube to open up all the way. And one simple way to do that is just to raise your knees above your waist. And you don't have to, you know, like necessarily buy anything branded, like a stack of books is totally fine. But it is why in the past, like thousands and thousands of years ago, like people were just squatting to go to the, like, that is the most natural way to have a bowel movement. And like, I have a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old. And like, if you go to daycares and you see all these kids who are in diapers, they just pop the deepest squat of their lives when they're pooping, you know, like they don't sit on a chair to poop. When you're a kid and you're trying to do it the most natural way, you know, instinctively how you squat.
Yeah. I'm having like flashbacks to childhood that I barely remember, but apparently I was very difficult to potty train, like a late bloomer. I don't know why my mom talks about that.
Everyone's a little different.
Mm-hmm. Which you also talk about, that's really interesting. That's another tangent, but you know, how we train children to go to the restroom and how that manifests today with bathroom habits. And so you are a big fan, which I have actually, shockingly, despite my obsession with all this topic, I have never used a bidet.
Oh my gosh, your life would change.
So I hear from your book. So, so why should people consider possibly getting a bidet?
Yeah, a bidet is like one of those things. It actually doesn't totally surprise me that you haven't tried one. I feel like the bidet is like the last frontier. I could convince somebody to eat fermented foods then before I could convince them to get a bidet sometimes. Because people are like, this is just like not something we do that much in America. Like Japan, Europe, they have this like down to a T, down to a science. But here, it's like such an odd concept to people. But just to like explain what a bidet is, why I think it's amazing, is a bidet is just a nozzle. It's this not like the simplest form of it is just a nozzle attachment that can be cheap. Like you could buy it for $30. You can install it yourself. It attaches to your own clean water supply and it just sprays the area. And what's lovely about this, and then, you know, I'll say there's like another range. There's another end of this spectrum where you can get like a full-blown,
the elite.
Yeah, like a heated seat and the water should be warm.
I want a Gucci bidet.
Yeah, it's like a magical experience and like there's air dryers built in. All of that's great. And then like in a Boston winter, it's a wonderful thing, but it doesn't have to be, you don't have to like splurge $600 for this. But what's great about it is that one, people feel cleaner. And there have been studies that have shown that like the hands of people who use bidets after they poop versus the hands of people who wipe after they poop are much cleaner. That's like not that surprising. There's just like 10 times fewer microbes on those hands when you use a bidet. And you know, it's like if you get poop anywhere else on your body, you usually don't just like wipe it off with a paper towel. Like I wouldn't do that. If I'm like changing my kid's diaper, I get a little smear of poop. I'm not just going to wipe it off and move on. I'm going to go wash my hands. But we do that for our butts for whatever reason. But even the hygiene thing, like, you know, that's kind of like a personal preference. But there are actually a lot of populations that I think would benefit from a bidet. They just haven't had the opportunity because they don't even really know what they're missing out on. But for example, like women, especially postpartum, they have a lot of inflammation and swelling there. A bidet is the absolute best. Like if you are on your period, and a lot of women have like either having these like bloody periods and they also have severe diarrhea during their periods, that's very common. A bidet just like helps you feel fully cleaned. A lot of men and women for that matter kind of have hairy posteriors. If you have a lot of hair back there, you often don't feel like just wiping really gets the job done. Like, but a bidet will totally get the job done. So there's just like an endless number of people who would benefit. And like I mentioned earlier on, a lot of my patients have Parkinson's disease or have trouble with movement and balance. A bidet is a great thing because you don't have to reach back there and do a lot of manipulation. And it's really like more of a lifestyle thing. It's like one of those things that you feel so weird about. It's such an odd concept. And then when you just try it once, it's funny. Like I've never met someone who tried a bidet and was like, it was fine. I could take it or leave it. Like people tend to have very strong positive reactions. Like once you get a bidet, you have to tell everybody you know about how great your bidet is. Like people who have bidets can't shut up about them. And it's like, it's just like so odd. I mean, I'm obviously one of them, but it's like I never meet people who are neutral about it. So it's like, you know, don't knock it till you try it. And once you try it, I think you'd even surprise yourself about what you'd learn about how amazing they are.
Okay. I'm definitely looking into this, and I will report back, and then I will be shouting the praises from the rooftop as well. Well, speaking of, okay, here's something fascinating. This is one of the most fascinating mind-blown moments I had when I had the realization, speaking of toilet paper, which you, by the way, you have a lot in the book about your thoughts on toilet paper and, you know, two ply, not one ply. I feel bad because, okay, wait, I use like sustainable bamboo toilet paper. I realize that might be a little bit more problematic because of the softness factor. However, the brand I have is not that bad. And I didn't realize this until reading your book, but now looking at my own habits, I do the dabbing method. I don't do the wiping method.
Good for you. I love a dab. I think everybody should be dabbing. I think we overestimate how sturdy that skin is. Like that skin is so delicate. Like in our butts, it's like not actually like we think it's like must be so firm, like the back of our hands. It's not. It tears easily. We really need to be quite gentle with it. So like the less you can manipulate and touch it, if you could use water and use it a bidet, that's even better. But otherwise, just dab it away to the extent that you can. That's not always possible. I get that. Sometimes things are, if you have like a really liquidy bowel movement, like get yourself clean, but maybe just take a shower instead at some point.
Yeah. And to this point, so this was not in your book, but this was mind-blowing to me. I had a conversation with a friend. I don't know how this conversation started, but we were talking about whether or not you fold or, sorry, yes, whether or not you fold or wad toilet paper.
Oh my God, I love this conversation though.
And we had a massive realization because we started asking like everybody in my family. So that's, you know, male and female. And then I polled my audience. I will die on this hill. It looks like men fold and women wad. And I have a theory for why this is, but I don't know if if you've had this realization.
Interesting. I'm curious to know what your theory is. I'm a folder now that I'm thinking about it. I am a folder, but you tell me.
I have like an explanation for why you might be a folder, but my theory, actually, I think I might've realized this with my male co-host on my podcast. And then I started polling people, but my theory is that women, unless they're using a bidet, which most people are not yet, but we'll work on that. My theory is that women, we have to use toilet paper for all bowel like movements, for urination and for defecation. So we're always using toilet paper. It's not like a moment for us, but for men, like they don't use toilet paper when they're urinating, only when they're having a bowel movement. So I think they just take it more like it's like a more ceremonial thing. Like they,
it's like more ritualized. Yeah.
Because I promise you that I got so many responses to my poll, and like all the men were folders and all the women were waters. It's mind blowing. And I'm guessing with you, however, because you have this whole, you know, like you're very much aware of like the dabbing and the sensitive tissue, you know, it's probably more if you were to use it.
I think it's because I'm treating it more delicately. I'm like thinking through, but I also think that you're like, right, that obviously women were using it way more.
like all the time. So we don't have time for that. Like,
yeah, exactly. And there's just like a lot going on. That is so funny. I actually like, I'm so curious, like we should publish the results of that study and like see, figure out what it says about us.
I'm down if you want to.
Yeah. How, like what personality disorder do you have depending on how you fold your toilet paper?
And yeah. So, and there's so much more we could talk about just as like a hint. I won't even tell listeners the answer so that they have to get the book to know, but there's a fascinating section on passing gas and who is smellier. I'm not telling you the answer. Who does it more and why is this? So you have to get the book to find out. It was fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, what's even more fascinating is that someone's done those studies. Like that's the best part of it.
Oh my goodness. The study you said where they had to actually like smell the different gases. I was like, I can't. Like, I was laughing. I was like, this is wild.
How much would you have to pay someone? Although I have a feeling they did it for science. I have a feeling they did it for free.
Some people, I don't know, men are, you know, I feel like some men might find that funny, like they might enjoy doing that study, but.
Yeah, I know that fart maxing is a growing trend in a small group of people now, so I can see why you'd want to lean into that.
Oh my goodness, so funny. So this has been amazing. We didn't even remotely touch on everything. I'm just so grateful for your book and what you're doing, and what I really appreciate, and like I was saying in the beginning, is like there's so much science, there's so much clarification of a lot of myths and misunderstandings out there. And what I think is most important, especially given my own experience and knowing how like neurotic I can be, is that it's a very comforting book. Like it's not going to make you more neurotic. It's going to make you feel better about your bowel habits while empowering you to, you know, have the best ones that you can, including in public, which we didn't really talk about that, but you have a section on that and tips and tricks for that. So yeah, was there anything else you wanted to leave listeners with before we go?
I think that like one small thing just to like take a big bird's eye view about this is that I always want people to just talk to their provider, talk to your doctor, talk to your nurse practitioner, whoever it is, before something becomes an emergency. Like especially when we're younger, I feel like we just wait. We think bloating is not necessarily a big enough deal to bring up at a doctor's visit, or you know, like there's a little bit of bleeding in our stool, but it's probably hemorrhoids. You don't bring it up. Like don't wait for it to be an emergency. Just bring it up even when it's kind of feels like no big deal to you, but it's bothering you, because you might be surprised at how many solutions and ideas your doctor has. And then also we want to really, really make sure we're not missing a bigger problem.
Actually, to that point, I just wanted to point out, I really appreciated how it was near the very end of the book, but you had the whole section on the importance of believing the patient, and you tell, you know, a story about, you know, when you heard people kind of talking negatively about your dad, and because of how he, you know, and because of the type of patients he has, and he just told you basically, you know, as long as you're believing the patient, you know, that's what's important. And so I just so appreciated that. And also to the point about talking with the doctor, it's funny because I feel like people are, like you said, like embarrassed to bring these things up. It's kind of the equivalent if you go in a sex shop and you're embarrassed like about the workers there, but it's like they work there. Like why?
Yes, exactly. It's like, don't be embarrassed with me. Like,
why am I embarrassed? Like I'm getting my vibrator. Like they literally work here. So I just really thank you for what you're doing with, you know, believing the patient and empowering people to, you know, to speak up and work with a practitioner and make change beneficially. So thank you. I have one last question. It's super easy, but how can people best get your book?
Well, they can buy it anywhere books are sold, and they can also follow me on Instagram or TikTok. I'm at Trisha Pasricha MD on Instagram.
Perfect. So last rapid fire question, and it's just because I realize more and more each day the importance of mindset. So what is something that you're grateful for?
I love this question. I'm grateful for my health and for my two kids.
And your bidet.
Oh my God, of course. The heated bidet seat. Actually, that's like the real, that's not the necessity. That's the like want. And I'm definitely grateful for that.
I love it. Well, thank you so much, Trisha. This has been absolutely amazing. Can't wait to like see all of your future work and studies, and just thank you for everything that you do. This was really, really a pleasure and an honor.
This was a delight. No, thank you, Melanie. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, have a good rest of your day, and I will talk to you later.
Bye. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. For more information and resources, you can check out my book, What, When, Wine, as well as my supplement line, Avalon X. Please visit melanieavalon.com to learn more about today's guest, and always feel free to contact me at contact@melanieavalon.com. And always remember, you got this.